You so often say, when standing by a grave, he is at rest at last. Tonight you have seen something of that rest. You cannot begin to appreciate what these unfortunate spirits have to suffer before they can be brought to understand their condition and to turn to God. You are not allowed to enlighten them. As yet they do not deserve it. They must go on suffering until their suffering has rendered them fit to receive such enlightenment. Today it would have been of no avail. But there was also another reason why their condition was shown to you. With that, the spirit raised its voice and said solemnly, one of you has been harboring thoughts of suicide today, and was about to prepare for the deed. On hearing these words, a member of our circle uttered a startled cry and exclaimed, "It was I, O God, it was I." "Yes, it was you," replied the spirit in a gentle tone. "You had hoped to escape a burden that you have borne for years by killing yourself and so finding rest. Today you have seen what kind of rest you would have found. Now, I am sure, you will be forever cured of such thoughts. Thus, this evening has been of the greatest benefit to you." I paid particular attention to whether the things that were told or predicted by the mediums were so or would come true, for if we could verify those statements that were susceptible of proof, we had no reason for doubting the truth of those that were not. Of the many statements by spirits that I so verified, I shall cite a few that should convince any unprejudiced person. 1. A walk with a medium through my parish church. One day the medium from the city came to see me at my rectory. We were sitting together in my study, talking of casual matters, and my housekeeper, who was working in the kitchen, now and then entered the room. During one of her absences, the boy suddenly fell into a trance, and the spirit addressed me with the words, "Your housekeeper has just gone out to work in the garden. I want to make use of this opportunity to speak to you. Please show me your church." The fact that my housekeeper had gone into the garden could have been known neither to me nor to the boy in his human capacity, for the garden lay behind the rectory and could be reached from the kitchen only by passing through the rear hallway, from which a door opened onto it. We were both seated in a room on the opposite side of the house and could neither hear nor see what was going on in the kitchen or the garden. In response to his request to show him the church, I rose. The boy, still in a trance and with his eyes closed, followed me with ponderous steps. The church stood directly beside the rectory and was accessible from it without crossing the street. The church could be entered by a side door from my front yard. When we had done so, the spirit said, "I see that the altar stands directly above a human skeleton that is buried in the ground, and there are other skeletons buried beneath the nave. Once upon a time there was a graveyard here." I replied that I knew nothing of it. I also did not think it possible, for the church stood on a little knoll, and there was no space around it for graves. "Ask the oldest residents," he replied, "they may be able to tell you something about it." Then he turned his closed eyes toward the organ loft and said, "You know that I rarely give advice in purely material matters, but today I shall make an exception. You have bought an organ. Tell the organist that after he is through playing, he should always push the stops all the way back into place. 3 of the stops are still halfway out, which allows dust and moisture to enter the pipes. In time, this will impair the purity of their tone. I speak of it because fine, pure music contributes to the beauty of a divine service and thereby to the glory of God." The console of the organ was locked, so that neither the keys nor the stops could be seen, even had we been standing directly before the instrument and certainly not from where we were standing by the altar. From that distance we could have seen nothing even if the organ had been open. Its key was hanging in a closet in the vestry. We next went to one of the side altars. The altarpiece depicted the death of Joseph, with Jesus and Mary standing by his bedside. "This picture is not true to fact," he said. "Jesus was not present when Joseph died." We now passed several pictures showing the stations of the cross. When we reached the one depicting Veronica receiving back her handkerchief, on which the image of the blood-stained face of Jesus had appeared, I asked him whether this had really happened or whether it was merely a legend. "It is the truth and no legend," was the reply. Before the picture of the crucifixion, The spirit suddenly asked me, "What do you think caused Christ the greatest agony?" "Being nailed to the cross," I answered. "No," replied the spirit, "not being nailed to the cross, but thirst. The nails were driven through his hands and feet by the brutal executioner's assistants with a few quick blows, causing a numbness that was not excessively painful, just as in war many of your wounded did not in the first moment feel wounds from bullets or shell splinters, even severe ones. The worst thing is the thirst that follows loss of blood, as your wounded found. It can drive you crazy. No bodily pain can compare to the agony of dying of thirst." As we walked on, we came to a side chapel in which there was an ancient wooden carving of Mary, which centuries ago had stood in a nearby convent whose ruins were still to be found nearby. "This carving," said the spirit, "has long been sought by the suffering spirits bound to remain near the ruined convent in the valley below." In amazement I asked, "Why is it that those spirits have not been able, in all this time, to find this carving of Mary, when it is so easy to find here? And besides, what good can it do them?" "You do not understand? Then I will explain it to you. Spirits that are punished for their misdeeds by being restricted to a certain spot may not pass beyond the limits set for them. For this reason, the spirits bound to that valley near the ruins of the convent may not come as far as this church. They may seek the carving of Mary only within their restricted area, and they cannot find it there. As to the good it would do them to find it is true that the carving itself cannot help them, but there was something connected with the carving that formerly brought them relief. While the carving was still in the convent, many people went to pray before it. On these occasions, prayers were also said for the poor souls, as you call suffering spirits. Such prayers cannot, indeed, lessen the guilt of the spirits or reduce their punishment, but they hear the prayers, and their thoughts are thereby turned toward God. This alleviates their agony. Since the carving was taken away from the convent, nobody goes there to pray anymore, and the spirits miss the relief that the prayers brought them. They know that these were associated with the presence of the image of Mary, and so they are eager to recover it." By this time we had reached the stairway leading to the organ loft. I was curious about the stops that had not been pushed back into place, but at the moment my mind was occupied with another thought. I was wondering whether this spirit could play the organ, that the boy could not, I knew for a fact. I had only one doubt: would the spirit have enough control over the boy's body to move his hands and feet as rapidly as playing an organ required? It was with some hesitation, therefore, that I asked him to play. "Gladly," replied the spirit, "if it will give you pleasure." I hurried back to the vestry for the key to the organ, and we ascended the stairs leading to the organ loft. Unlocking the keyboard, I immediately looked at the stops. Sure enough, three of them were halfway out. The spirit repeated its injunction to point this out to the organist. The boy then sat down at the organ, pulled out stops and began to play, at first softly and gently, in sweet, harmonious chords. Then somewhat louder. The longer he played, the louder the swell of the notes became. At the climax, the organ surged and thundered and roared with all stops drawn, like a hurricane that pulls out trees by the roots. Then slowly the music ebbed until it died away in wonderfully gentle and peaceful sounds. There could be no doubt, here sat an organ master. When he had finished playing, he pushed all the stops into place and rose from his seat. I locked the organ again. Stepping in front of me, he asked, "Do you know what it was that I just played?" "No," I answered. "That was your life," said the spirit quietly. I looked at him in astonishment, for I could not imagine that a person's life could be played on a musical instrument. As though reading my thoughts, he instructed me as follows: "A person's life is like a painting. It can be painted in colors and also in notes. Every color represents a note, and every note a color. There are clairvoyants who see all tones in their colors, and who do not distinguish harmony from discord by ear, but by looking at the colors of the tones. It is therefore possible, at least for spirits, to reproduce every painting in sound, as though one were playing from sheet music." I was unable to comprehend this explanation. The thought was too new to me. Silently we descended the stairway to the nave of the church and went to the door by which we had entered. Here my companion stopped and said, "Now I must leave you. I cannot go with you to the rectory because your housekeeper is on the point of leaving the garden and going into the house, and I do not want her to see the boy in trance. I shall now stand close to the wall. You support the boy's body, so that he will not fall down when I depart from him." I did as I was bidden and found that it required my full strength to keep the boy from sinking over forward as the spirit left him. He at once regained his faculties and was much surprised to find himself in the church with me, as he remembered only that he had sat with me in the rectory. Of what had happened in the meantime he knew nothing. When I told him that he had played the organ so beautifully, he shook his head incredulously. The moment we opened the rectory door, my housekeeper stepped from the garden into the rear of the hallway. Had the spirit not left the medium when it did, she could not have failed to see the boy in his trance state. Later, when I spoke to the boy about the events that had occurred, he disclaimed all knowledge of skeletons, organ stops, the death of Joseph, Veronica's handkerchief, the agony of the crucifixion, the image of Mary and its history, the spirits restricted to the vicinity of the convent ruins and the effect of prayer upon them, or of the organ recital and what I had been told in connection therewith. That very evening I learned by inquiry that the site now occupied by the church had long ago really been a graveyard. 2. A member of a monastic order attends spiritist gatherings. One message, delivered one evening through the farmer boy of my parish as a speaking medium, seemed very improbable to us. It was to the effect that a monk from the neighboring Benedictine monastery was attending spiritist seances held in a city not far away. We could scarcely believe that a monk, wearing the habit of his order, would take part in a spiritist gathering, in view of the strong opposition of the Catholic Church to spiritism. There was no way for us to verify this communication, but its correctness was soon to be demonstrated through an unforeseen channel. I had been reported to my ecclesiastic authorities as a frequenter of spiritist meetings, and a commission was sent to question me about the matter. The hearing was to be held at the very Benedictine monastery in question, and I was ordered to appear there. At the hearing I frankly admitted having attended spiritist gatherings and having instituted them in my parish. I was reminded that all Catholics had been forbidden by an order that came from Rome to attend any such meetings. I protested that I had heard nothing of such a prohibition, but that, if the facts were as alleged, I could not understand why a priest from that selfsame monastery should also be attending meetings of that sort. I said this, not to defend myself, but merely to learn in this way whether it was actually true that a priest from this monastery was attending spiritist meetings, as the medium had stated. The head of the investigating committee indignantly denied the truth of my assertion that a priest from the monastery was attending spiritist meetings and emphatically maintained that this was impossible. His habit alone would prevent him from going. He added that he must therefore reject my statement as heavily slanderous. I answered calmly that I had not brought the matter up to cause the monk or the monastery any trouble, but that I had heard it from a certain source and was taking this way of verifying the truth of the story. Should my statement prove false, I would see to it that my informant was set right. The head of the investigating committee then interrupted my hearing and went, I presume, to see the abbot of the monastery. After a short absence he returned with an embarrassed expression, and admitted that I was right. In his defense he added that the monk in question had received permission from the abbot to visit spiritist meetings. The truth of what the medium had told me was thus established. 3. In the course of the proceedings brought against me I received confirmation after confirmation of the reports and predictions made by the mediums about my affairs. One day I was summoned before the bishop. Scarcely had his letter reached me, when the farmer boy of my parish, the speaking medium, came to my rectory and said, "I have been obliged to come to see you. You have received a letter from your episcopal superior, ordering you to appear before him on." I asked the boy how many lines there were in the letter, even that he knew exactly. Thereupon he passed into a state of trance, and the spirit that spoke through him encouraged me with the words, "You need have no fear. Trust God and do not be afraid. What can people do to you?" I replied that I intended to acknowledge before the bishop the convictions I had acquired as a result of my communications with the spirit world, and that I fully expected to lose my position as a minister of the Catholic Church in consequence. "The bishop will ask you no questions on spiritism, or about any convictions you may have derived from it," said the spirit, "at some time in the future you will be granted leave. Your separation from your parish will come about in peace between you and your church, and not by way of dismissal." I could hardly imagine that the bishop would fail to ask me about the spiritist gatherings and the truths revealed there, but it turned out just as the medium had predicted. The bishop read to me the edict issued by the Congregation of Rome in 1917, which stated that Catholics were not allowed to attend spiritist gatherings, had me sign a paper acknowledging that he had brought the ban to my notice, and imposed a penance on me for my past violations of the ban. But of spiritism itself he said not a word. Somewhat later I had the painful experience of seeing a certain prediction communicated through the medium in the city come true. I had been told at a séance that a member of the circle in that city was going to betray me. We did not believe that there was anyone among us capable of such betrayal, and yet, the seemingly impossible happened. A woman of our circle denounced me to the episcopal authorities for my continued attendance at spiritist séances. This seemed to make my dismissal a foregone conclusion. I had, as it happened, applied for a leave of absence to allow me to devote myself to charitable work, but the episcopal vicariate had rejected my application so brusquely that humanly speaking there seemed to be no hope of its being granted. The case against me in the ecclesiastical courts took its course, and a day was set for the main hearing, to which I received a summons. Only a few days remained until this hearing, which, I was sure, would result in my dismissal. Nevertheless, I still had faith in the prediction that had been made to me that I should be allowed to depart from my parish in peace with my church by way of being granted leave. Then, at the 11th hour, I had a telegram from the Ecclesiastic Council notifying me that proceedings against me had been dropped for the time being by directive of the bishop. Soon afterwards he wrote me, granting me leave of absence and asking me when I would like to surrender my parish. I replied, giving him the date, December 31, 1925, the day which had long before been predicted as that on which my connection with my parish would terminate. 4. In Whitsuntide of 1924 I was travelling to Graz in Styria. On the stretch between Passau and Vienna I was alone with a young man in a railroad compartment, seated opposite him and reading, when I saw his head suddenly drop forward as though he had fallen asleep. Almost instantly he straightened up again, sat with his eyes closed, took a notebook out of his pocket and covered a page of it with writing. Then he tore out the page and handed it to me saying, "Take this and keep it. What its meaning is, you will be told elsewhere." I looked at the writing but could not decipher the characters. At that moment the young man recovered consciousness. He did not know that he had written anything or that he had given me the paper, nor did he remember a word of what he had said to me. He, too, was unable to read the characters set down on the paper. After my return from Graz to my parish I carried the paper about in my pocket for 2 weeks. One Saturday evening I arrived at the home of my speaking medium's family. The boy was alone in the room. After a few moments he fell into a trance and said, "Show me the paper you have with you, which was given you on your journey to Graz." When I had given it to him, he read it and said, "Tomorrow afternoon a Jew will come to see you. People think he is sick, but as a matter of fact he is being tormented by an evil spirit that has such power over him that he can scarcely utter a word. As soon as he comes, call the boy through whom I am speaking. Leave all the rest to me. You will see mighty things." This note was written by the Jew's guardian spirit through the medium whom you met on your trip to Graz. It is the spirit of a deceased uncle of his, who lived in Cologne. The evil spirit tormenting the Jew is also that of a deceased relative. At 4 o'clock the next afternoon someone rang the rectory doorbell. I opened the door and was startled at seeing a man whose limbs were contorted and whose head was jerking back and forth nervously. He tried to speak but could not utter a word. I took his hand and led him to my room, and at once sent for the boy. He came, fell into a trance before the Jew, rose, stretched out his hand as though exorcising the visitor, and addressed him in a foreign language that I could not understand. The Jew was tossed back and forth several times by an invisible force, then he was freed from the evil influence, wept for joy and began to speak without any difficulty. He told me that he knew quite well what had just taken place. He himself, he said, had the power of clairvoyance and could distinguish the spirits about him, good and evil ones. His good spirit was that of an uncle of his from Cologne, the evil one was that of a relative whom he had not known in this life. The evil spirit had tried to prevent him from coming to see me and on his way to my house had shouted the vilest epithets and curses at him in Hebrew, some of which he repeated to me. Now he hoped that he was forever rid of the spirit. He knew also what spirit it was that had just set him free. Taking his prayer book out of his pocket, he showed me a Hebrew prayer to one of the high celestial powers. The Jew had not been mistaken, it was the very spirit who was then present. While I was still talking to the Jew, the boy once more went into a trance and turned to me, saying, "What I am telling you now cannot be heard by this man. His senses are being dulled so that he cannot understand me. The things that have just happened were shown as an object lesson to you and to him also. He will be freed from his evil spirit for a short time only, for the spirit will come back and torment him until his death. He has merited this punishment. He will not come to see you again, for he will never again be able to muster the strength to do so." I asked the Jew whether he had understood what had just been said, and he replied that he had heard nothing. Deeply moved, I bade him farewell and have never seen him since. 5. I had often had my attention called by the various mediums to the fact that many falsifications had been introduced into the documents that dated back to the early days of the Christian era, and I had asked myself repeatedly whether there were not some scholarly work in which the attempt had been made to uncover these falsifications. I knew of no such work and could find no one else who did. At our meetings I had purposely refrained from asking about the matter, as I had been told that everything that could be of use to me would be brought into my hands. One day I unexpectedly received two deliveries of a publication. The pages had not been cut. A letter from a lady whom I had met only once in my life was included. It read, "The books I am sending were given to me for you the day before yesterday by Mrs. H. of F. She had to send them to you at once, without even reading them herself. Mighty things are happening to her. Be sure to look her up before long. NN." The Mrs. H., who had been compelled to send these works to me, was a total stranger to me, even by name. These publications, of whose content she herself knew nothing, contained proof that a document by the Jewish author Flavius Josephus had been most brazenly falsified in favor of the Christian religion by Christian copyists, who had made Flavius Josephus, a despiser of Christ, into one of his admirers. There were also many references in these publications that had been sent to me to the intentional falsifications of the writings of the early centuries, thus confirming everything that I had been told about this by mediums entirely unfamiliar with such matters. This discovery pleased me greatly. I obtained confirmation of the general truth of communication with spirits and of many individual facts in this field during my stay in America, where spiritism under the designation spiritualism is widespread, there being great numbers of so-called spiritualistic churches. At the outset I made use of the opportunity of becoming acquainted with the way in which spiritism was practiced in these churches by attending the services in many of them. Unfortunately, my visits confirmed what I had heard from the mediums in Germany, who had again and again told me that God's good spirits will not go near places frequented by people more concerned with temporal matters than with progress on the path leading to God. Only spirits of the lower orders, I had been informed, appeared at meetings at which materialistic views predominated. I was also told that there is no control over the spirits at such gatherings, which become the stamping ground for spirits who come from the lower spheres without necessarily being downright evil. Generally, they are those of relatives, friends, or acquaintances of those attending, spirits that have themselves progressed but little in the beyond and are therefore more interested in the temporal affairs of those whom they have left behind than in their spiritual advancement. Such gatherings are then no longer divine services, but rather information bureaus for worldly questions and interests, and they come dangerously close to what took place at the idolatrous ceremonies of the pagans. The attraction of idolatry lay precisely in the fact that the people hoped to receive information relating to their worldly success and their earthly future from the mediums participating in the idol worship. I encountered nothing lofty and edifying in any of these churches, however much I longed for it. On the contrary, what I generally found was of a nature to hurt rather than to advance the cause of Spiritism. I also had the impression that the people attending these meetings were there merely for the sake of messages they hoped to receive about worldly matters, and that the question of money seemed to play no minor part with the leaders of these churches. A fixed admission fee was charged, generally at least half a dollar, a lot of money in the early 1930s, which meant that the really poor were unable to attend. All this substantiated what I had been so insistently told in Germany about modern Spiritism, even when it is conducted with an outward show of respect for religious forms, and I became convinced that Spiritism of this kind will not bring humanity much closer to God. It is not the Spiritism of the early Christians. Nevertheless, it was my good fortune to meet with the higher aspects of Spiritism in America also, and thereby to corroborate my previous experiences. During my stay in New York, I lived with a German family called Neumann at 148 East 18th Street. I am giving the name and address because this family played a leading role in the events to be related and has authorized me to make public its identity. Elsewhere in this book, I have refrained, on principle, from mentioning names to preclude the possibility of any unpleasant consequences to anyone at the hands of ill-disposed persons as a result of the publication. I had never spoken to Mr. Neumann about Spiritism, but only told him of some of my experiences in the Spiritist churches of New York. He himself was not a member of any church and seemed to have lost his belief in God. As for what I told him of the occurrences at the Spiritist meetings, he considered the whole thing a fraud and a money-making scheme. Nevertheless, out of curiosity, he decided one evening to accompany me to a meeting at one of these churches. Like all those present, he, too, received a message. What was told to him there was correct in all particulars, in spite of the fact that the medium had never seen him before, and naturally did not know who he was. He was informed, among other things, that he possessed great mediumistic powers and was urged to cultivate them. After we had returned home, he asked me what the medium had meant by urging him to cultivate his mediumistic powers, upon which I explained the situation and offered to hold services with him and Mrs. Neumann once or twice a week. This would, of course, give me a further opportunity to verify what I had learned in Germany, even though I no longer had any doubts on that score. I held the services as I had in the small circle in my parish, as already described. Here, then, on the opposite side of the ocean, in a family which had abandoned its belief in God, but which was honestly and sincerely willing to accept the truth, I watched the development of mediums' progress exactly as it had progressed in the case of the mediums I had observed in my former environment. Thus, both there and here, the laws governing the development of mediums were the same. On the very first evening, Mr. Neumann began mediumistic writing, conscious of the fact that he was writing, but unaware of what he was writing. The various passages he wrote were done in different handwritings and were signed with the names of different relatives and friends, whom Mr. Neumann remembered only when he saw their signatures affixed to what he had written that evening. They all assured him that in acting as he was choosing the right path. They told him to keep to it, for they themselves would have been only too happy if someone had shown them this way to God while they were alive. The messages affirmed that there was a beyond and a God, in whom, they said, he should trust. When Mr. Neumann came out of his trance and read what he himself had set down in different handwritings, he was speechless. Subsequently, he and his wife held the service in my absence, and again he wrote as on the first occasion, much to his wife's surprise, for she secretly believed that I had hypnotized her husband and had transmitted to him by telepathy the thoughts he had committed to writing. Now, however, she had proof to the contrary, because he had done his mediumistic writing in the same manner even when I was not present.